Going to the toilet is another way of practicing letting go. But that's not the subject of tonight's talk. Somebody asked me just as we were coming in here, and this is just to start the talk and see where it leads to. They said, can you please let everybody know that Buddhism is not a religion? Because sometimes religion has got a bad name, a bad rap, as they say, in Western culture, because religion has caused so many problems and difficulties, and I mean real problems and wars and a lot of abuse in the name of religion. So, you know, can we say that Buddhism is not part of that? And it's one of those questions which people often ask, is Buddhism a religion? And to get the joke out of the way quickly, we always answer, yes, it is a religion for tax purposes. But is it really a religion for other purposes? And I was just reminded, I gave a talk yesterday at Mental Health Institute for some spirituality and mental health. And quite a few of the presenters there were very religious. And one of them reminded me of the meaning of the word religion. It comes from a Latin word meaning to bind, to tie you up. And sometimes, is a Buddhism, does it tie you up? If it is, you're misunderstanding it, because the purpose of Buddhism is actually to free you. Not to bind you, but to actually to give you freedom. And it's an important part to understand this. This is real Buddhism, to free you. So if it binds you up, in other words, you have to do these obligations to some deity, or to the church, or even if you think you have an obligation to the monk or to the nuns, then you're missing the point. So first of all, the Buddhism or the Dhamma or the truth, spirituality, is supposed to liberate you, free you from obligations, which is why you don't have to pay to get in here. You have no obligations at all. People often ask me, do you have to pay to get in? They say, no, you don't have to pay to get in at all. You have to pay to get out. You don't even have to do that either. So there's no obligations of supporting. These donation boxes there if you want to. But you can see that just we have got some of the smallest donation boxes anywhere in the world. And sometimes, any of you come and visit our monasteries, you see that sometimes you can't find the donation box. People go searching for them. Whereas in other places, they've got big neon signs, donation box, stop here. So we're not really into actually forcing this, because that would be like an obligation. That would be like a religious obligation. I know that in Christianity you're supposed to pay a tithe, which is 10% of your income pre-tax. I don't know why anybody does that, because you get much better teachings, much better service here for far less cost. This is cut price, we have cut price airfares. This is cut price spirituality. It's also a high quality as well. But we're not doing this, you know, because of markets or anything. This is not a business. It's freeing, so everything is done. Not to bind you and obligate you, but to free you. So everything is for free here. And sometimes people wonder, where does all this place come from? You know, where does the temple come from? We get a big retreat center coming in a week or two's time. $5 million worth of retreat center. And it all comes from kindness, non-obligated generosity. And I think that's one of the most important things, I think, in our modern world. Too often, you know, that you have a can in front of you and you're sort of forced to give. You know, or you send messages sort of in the emails about the importance of giving. We don't do that here. And I was actually taught by my teacher, Ajahn Chah, if you're going to be a monk, Ajahn Brahm, and especially a teacher, first thing, don't ask for anything. And there's a story in the ancient Vinaya, this is the ancient scriptures of the Buddha, about monks 2,500 years ago who were asking people things. They were actually building their monastery and they were asking just for small things like an axe or some wood or, you know, some metal or something. And they were asking so many things from the poor lay people. Well, the lay people got so afraid of monks that when they saw brown cows coming in the distance, they hid in their houses and closed the doors and windows in case, because they thought the brown cows were monks coming to ask for more things. So you've got to be careful there. Don't ask for anything. This is generosity. This is freedom with no obligations. So you're not bound to do anything when you come here. You know, as I was saying last week, some people bow, some people don't. Fine, you are most welcome whatever you do. Of course, within reason. I'm talking about bowing or not bowing, and sometimes how you bow. It's really funny being a monk, seeing the way some people bow. Some Westerners have bowed. I've never seen that ever before. It's probably the first time in 2,500 years anybody's ever bowed like that. Unique and funny, it makes me laugh. But you're free to do that. But the most important thing about the Buddhism is you're also just free to take responsibility. And this is the most important part of the fact that Buddhism is not a religion. Because it doesn't tell you what to do. It doesn't tell you what to believe. It tells you how to find out. It puts the responsibility onto you. A monk is not like a priest who is your conduit to a higher authority. You can only get to that higher authority through this conduit, this priest, which is one of the reasons why priests are there. You can't get to a God or a Jesus or Allah or not sure whoever, except through, I think not through in Islam, they don't have those conduits of priests. You can't get to them except by this man, usually, who knows all the rituals. And that means that you're not free. You can't do things you want to do. But in Buddhism, we always have open doors. So if anybody wants to come in, you can always open them. We don't lock people. Except by mistake. So anyone can walk in, all sorts of weirdos. I'm not talking about the monk or you. But, you know, we do get some strange people sometimes on a Friday night, and even in our monastery as well. But the point is, there is a sense of, like, this compassionate sense of freedom. But the most important thing here, not telling you what to believe or what to do, but encouraging, leading, helping, serving, and helping you find out what to do. And the most important thing here is, because there's no obligation, because there's no telling, because there's no control, it means you are free. So Buddhism is a religion of freedom, of external freedom, first of all, giving you that choice. And whatever you do, for those of you who've come here for a long time, you're never criticized or shouted at. You know, even though sometimes I say that sometimes it's hard to resist criticizing or shouting at someone, but you don't because it's not Buddhist. And even when some of you come on retreats, and those of you who come on retreats, you have interview times with the teacher. And when you have an interview with the teacher, those of you who have been on retreats with myself, sometimes you say, oh, I had a terrible day today, I slept all day, I ate too much, and I've been thinking about girlfriends or whatever. And I say, very good. You never get criticized. And there's an important meaning behind that. Because we don't have blame, because blame, criticism, is one other means of controlling people. So we don't have control. We have freedom instead. For everyone who comes to a place like this, to take whatever they want from the teachings, and to use it in any way which they want, they take responsibility for their body, speech, and mind. And however much responsibility you take, however much you understand this, whatever you do with this, you'll still be welcome. And you'll still have the friendship and the respect of the people sitting up here. And hopefully you respect one another. So there's no force or compulsion. It's not a religion which binds you. It's a teaching which, if you understand it well, frees you. So the freedom is an important part of Buddhism. And the interesting thing with that word freedom, so I used it at the end of the meditation, is many people just don't understand what freedom means. And because we don't understand the meaning of freedom, we can never have the experience of real freedom. We think we live in a free society. But when we look at the freedom of our society, do we really feel liberated and at ease to come and go and do whatever we want? Or do we feel sometimes we're in a box? We're constrained and controlled, and we can't get out of this box which is called our life. Do you really feel free? Now, it's strange for me being a monk. A monk with 227 main rules and thousands, we can't count them, of minor rules which we have to keep. There's so many things which I cannot do. And sometimes people think, wow, being a monk, you must feel just so hemmed in on all sides. But the experience of being a monk is actually you feel incredibly free. And all these little things which are supposed to control you, are actually, you don't feel controlled at all, but you feel quite liberated and quite free. And this is what happens also when, you know, you guys and girls, you come and stay in a monastery for a short time. And you'll be surprised. When you come and stay in a monastery or you go on a retreat, you have to keep many of the same rules that the monks and nuns keep, such as not eating in the afternoon, no TV, no radio, no sort of entertainment. You can't wear makeup when you come on a retreat. You know, so many things you just can't do, which you're used to. But people actually, they don't feel that these rules are hemming them in. But they actually feel they're made free by these rules. Because what the lifestyle, what the path, what the method is doing, is giving you a real freedom. And that, I've mentioned this before, and it's a very profound point. It goes to the heart of what Buddhism is teaching. It's called the freedom from desires, rather than the freedom of desires. There's two different freedoms. The freedom of desires, where you can do whatever you want, eat whatever you want, when you ever want. You get on Foxtel, I think it's called, and you can get so many different programs and movies, whatever you want, whenever you want it. You can get on the internet and buy whatever you want, see whatever you want, whenever you want it. Our whole Western culture, and Eastern culture again, has done a lot of work giving you more places to go, more things to see whenever you want to see it or go there. It's giving you more freedom of desire. However, when you have freedom of desire, it's no freedom at all. It's no freedom for you. You have all these different things and choices. I remember when I grew up in London, there was only two channels, BBC and ITV. And you wouldn't believe the arguments we had in the family on whether we should have BBC or ITV on. And that was only two channels. I don't know what you do. There must be wars in houses when there's so many channels to watch. And of course, what's the solution? Is have a TV for every person in the house so they can watch whatever they want, which means a lot of separation and loneliness because we don't do things together. But even going into shopping malls, I had to go in a shopping mall, was it yesterday? And the amount of stuff which is on sale there, it must just drive you guys crazy going to places like this. I remember when I used to go to shops as a layperson, you know, if it was like muesli, there's maybe two brands of muesli. You know, choose this one or that one. Even baked beans. You know, just have so many different brands of baked beans. Baked beans with chili, baked beans with no salt, baked beans with... It must drive you guys crazy. I remember of a story, this was many years ago, of this guy who came from the Eastern Europe. This was before the fall of the Berlin Wall. where in the communist countries they had very, very few things. And when he went into his first supermarket, this guy from Eastern Europe was just amazed at the amount of products which was available to people. What he was really amazed at, you know, he saw first of all milk powder. Because, you know, in the Eastern Europe you get milk from a cow. Here it's a packet of dust. And so just add water and you get milk. So, wow, these Westerners are so clever. You know, just add water and you get milk. And then he saw instant mashed potato. Again, just powder. Just add water and you get potatoes. Because, you know, if in the old days you had to peel the potatoes, so boil them up and smash them before you get mashed potatoes, so amazing. But what really surprised him, he thought, wow, these Westerners, they're just so incredibly intelligent. Don't know how they could do this, because he saw, after seeing the milk powder and the mashed potato powder, he saw on one of the stores baby powder. Just add water. But he didn't realize that's not what baby powder means. But it would be much easier, because there's a few people here just given birth, got their new babies. So 9 months and all that labor pain. It would be wonderful if you did have real baby powder. Just wanted the baby, you know, you can just decide the sex, you know, the nationality, whatever, and just add water. Well, that's another thing. One day someone will invent that. But the amount of choice there, do you feel free with so much choice? And the reason why people feel more free when they're on a retreat, staying in a monastery, or becoming a monk or a nun, is because in a monastery we have freedom from desire. We don't want so much. And we feel an enormous sense of freedom. Not having the money to buy things. Not having the rules to stop us choosing things. Imagine what it's like being a monk getting up in the morning and thinking, what should I wear today? We don't have to look at fashion magazines like Vogue or, well, I don't know what the other ones are, that's the only one I can remember. You notice there are no of these magazines for monks and nuns. We don't have to look at the latest robe or the latest fashion. We don't have to spend thousands of dollars getting like a fashion designer robe made by Gucci or made by Versace. It's so easy getting up in the morning and not having to worry what you wear. Even your hairstyle. You know, we've been doing this for 2,500 years. You just shave your hair. You don't have to go to the hairdresser and think, what's the latest style? What can I wear today? What color should I dye my hair? Shave it all off. It's much cheaper and much freer. And you don't have... Monks and nuns never, ever have a bad hair day. It's so easy. So you can see how many freedoms we get. Now, the story behind this... Many of you probably know this story. Some of the stories I have to keep repeating because they just fit in the right place of the talk. What do you mean by freedom? Well, why Buddhism is not a religion which binds you, but which frees you from desires, is the story of, you know, what enlightenment is. And the usual way I describe this, the best way, is the old story of the five children playing the wishing game. The reason I tell this story is because people who come to places like this, they say, you know, we're trying to become enlightened, but what does that mean? What is enlightenment? And it's important to have a good understanding of what we're doing here. And to get that good understanding, we don't want to give you gobbledygook understandings. Because even yesterday, one of the presenters at the mental health seminar told me that from Talhar to Chardin, he was saying, God is the ground of all being. Is that inspiring? But what do you mean by the ground of all being? I know what the ground where we're putting the the pipes in our retreat center, that ground, I know what that ground is, making me really dirty and stepping in it. What do you mean by the ground of all being? Explain yourself. And when you actually ask mystics, sort of, you know, what do you mean by these things? They just say another mystical word, the ineffable. It's beyond words. And that never convinced me. It was one of the reasons why I turned away from Christianity or God belief. To believe in a God or not to believe in a God. What is this God I'm supposed to believe in or not believe in anyway? And I remember when I was at school, going to the school chaplain, I got a scholarship to go to this good school in West London, I had a chaplain there, and ask him, what is God? You know, it's important. You know, you're supposed to be the expert, you're the chaplain, let me know what God is. And he said, you know, that God is the Alpha and Omega. You know, you've got to know Greek to understand what that means. You know, it actually means, you know, the A to Z. So I thought God was like the local street directory, because in London, the A to Z was a street directory. It was a telephone book. The Alpha and Omega, it was beyond words, infinite, the ground of all being, the essence. I said, what do you mean by that? And it could never give me a straight answer. And there's something you can grab onto. And one thing which I always had in mind, and this was confirmed by other people, if you know what you're talking about, you can explain it to other people. And this is actually a quote of any scientists here from Werner Heisenberg. Now, you know him of the Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, but he did a huge amount of work on quantum physics. So-called one of the most complicated theories of physics we've ever had. And he was on record as saying, if you cannot explain quantum physics to the barmaid, this was in 1940-something, to the lady serving you beer behind in the pub, if you can't explain it to her and make her understand it, you don't understand it yourself. It's a great quote. He's saying, if you understand something, you can explain it to anybody. So, for me, it meant that chaplain did not understand what God was. So that's one of the reasons why I couldn't find anybody who gave me a decent understanding. So then I became a Buddhist. And then I went to temples and listened to talks. And then one day I asked a monk, Nibbana, what is enlightenment? Nirvana, what is it? And he said, it is the ground of all being. Beyond words. The infinite. And I said, I've heard that before somewhere. And it's true, a lot of monks and nuns and teachers, they don't understand what Nibbana is. But I got this great explanation of what Nibbana is. And this fits into what, you know, is Buddhism a religion? What's its goal? It's not sort of going to heaven and being with the Father. That's patriarchal for a start. You know, who wants to be with a father? What about with a mother? Out with the grandparents or whatever. But you know, it doesn't really make much sense. But I wanted something which really made sense. And this explanation of Nirvana also fits in to what we mean by freedom and the goal of life. So it's a great story, but like most stories, it's simple, amusing, and it comes across in the end with a very profound message. Don't ever assume that because it's easy to understand, it's not profound. Real religion, truth, should not be rocket science. It should be easy to understand. One of the reasons that some of the stories I say, they may be amusing, and it may be easy to understand, and people think, oh, it can't be profound, because I can understand it. No. If it really is profound, you do understand it, easily. Why should truth be mystical or difficult? That's an assumption we make in the West which is unfounded. Truth should be easy to understand. And I'm now going to demonstrate it for you. Five children playing the wishing game. It's a great story. The wishing game goes like this. Every child has to think of a wish, and the child who comes up with the best wish wins the wishing game. So the first child, a young boy, was thinking and said, yep, if I had a wish, I would wish for a Big Mac with double fries, an ice cream afterwards, and a Coke. Because my mother never allows me. She's a Buddhist, she comes to the temple, vegetarian, she never allows me to go and have a Big Mac. So that was his wish, fair enough. And asked the second girl, what's your wish? And the girl was thinking, and she'd heard what the boy said, had a bit more time, bit smarter than the boy, and said, if I had a wish, I would wish for a McDonald's restaurant. When I've got a restaurant, I can have many burgers whenever I want, and fries and everything else, because I own the joint. So that will be my wish for a McDonald's restaurant, and obviously a much better wish. So the third child, a boy, had again longer to think, and he thought, he was a very smart guy. He said, if I had a wish, let's put away these just restaurants, let's go big time. If I had a wish, I would wish for $1 billion. US. I think it's going up again now, was it? Which is worth more? No, actually, is euros worth more now? Okay, 1 billion euros. Because with 1 billion euros, I can buy my own McDonald's restaurant. That'd be first of all. There'd be plenty of money left. The next thing I would buy, said the boy, was my own video game store. Because I love playing video games. And I can get whatever video game I want. But thirdly, my mother is always stopping me playing video games, saying I should do my homework. So the third thing I will buy is my own school. Because when I own the school, I can always give myself top marks. I employ the teachers. And at the end of my school career, I spend all the time playing video games and no homework because I own the school. When I graduate from my own school, I'll sell the school and buy my own university. You've got lots of universities in the United States where they can give you degrees for anything. So I buy my own university, and at the end of 2 or 3 years, give myself a first-class honors degree or whatever, and I can spend all my time doing video games. And he said, with $1 billion, when I grow up, I'll still have many, many millions left to do whatever else I want, whenever I want it. Because $1 billion, you just cannot spend in a whole lifetime. And so the third child was a child with a $1 billion wish. Beat that. Saying $2 billion or $3 billion, it's not beating it at all. It's the same. It means like as much money as you can ever spend. So the fourth child, the girl, had to think very deeply. How can I do better than the €1 billion wish? She was really clever. She said, I can beat that. She said, if I had a wish, I would wish for 3 wishes. That's a wish. For my first wish, I'd have the McDonald's restaurant. My second wish, I'd have the €1 billion. And for my third wish, I'll have 3 more wishes. That way, I can go on forever. Beat that. So the fourth child was a child with the infinity of wishes. Can you do better than that? The fifth child won the wishing game. Very clearly. He managed to think of a wish which was clearly superior than having an infinity of wishes granted. Whenever you wanted a wish, it was granted for you. That fifth child said, if I had a wish, I wish I was so content I never needed any more wishes ever again. So content I don't need any more wishes. That was a child who won the wishing game. That's what enlightenment means. So content. Your desires and cravings are gone. You don't need them anymore. It's called the freedom from desire. The freedom from craving. You just don't need things anymore. If they come, fine. If they don't come, fine. You're free from craving, free from desire. And that means that Buddhism is not something which binds you to craving and to wanting and to having to consume and having to possess and own and control. It's freeing you from all of those things, which is why we call it letting go. It's freedom, not binding. So the whole path of Buddhism is learning how to be free. And the ultimate freedom, so content, you don't need any more desires. Imagine that. It means you want for nothing. You have enough. How wealthy are you? Have you got enough yet? Is there anyone here who's got too much money? Of course, no one will admit that. Even though other people say, yes, you have. But no one thinks they've got too much money. Everybody thinks it's not enough. Why? It's because you still have more cravings, more desires, more things you want. Now that will never give you any peace in life. Whenever there's cravings and desires, where will you ever find a place to rest and have peace? In 2 weeks' time, we're opening up our retreat center, Jhana Grove. Been working my butt off, and all the other monks for the last, at least the last 7 days since I was last here, trying to finish it off. But who knows, will it be finished in time or not? Isn't it exciting? And it reminds me of one of the great stories of contentment, being free from desires. This was that monastery in Thailand many, many years ago, because this monk died a long time ago. And he wasn't building a retreat center, he was building his main meditation hall in this monastery. And as he was building his hall, it came to the rainy season retreat, the 3 month retreat period. We practice that here. In that 3 month retreat, the monks and nuns go back to their monasteries, we don't come and give talks here. Those of you who've been around a while know that from mid-July to October, we disappear. So by the time this retreat was about to start, the hall wasn't finished. It was not complete. The builders were slow. Things went wrong. And the day after the retreat started, a visitor came to see this monk. And just asked, quite casually, when is your hall going to be finished? And the monk said, sir, the hall is finished. What do you mean it's finished? Said the visitor. There's no glass in the windows. The bamboo floor hasn't been installed yet. There's bricks all over the place. There's no roof. There's no doors on. What do you mean it's finished? Are you going to leave it like this? And this monk said something which shows what nirvana is and how we can be free from desires. He said, sir, what's done is finished. And then he went off and had a nice meditate. Isn't that a beautiful attitude in life? What's done is finished. Otherwise, when will you ever get anything done in life? So when you really understand this, what's done is finished, he understood the importance of just resting, having a retreat. Yeah, we'll finish it later off. But right now, what's done is finished. Now I can give myself some peace. I am not controlled by my desires and having to get things finished. So, if our retreat center down in Serpentine, there's still things missing in fortnight's time, I'll just tell the building inspector from the Shire, oh, what's done is finished. And the health inspector, well, you know, the toilets aren't connected yet, oh, but what's done is finished. But maybe there's some things you can't do there, but here you can, in your life, if you are always in the power and controlled by desires, you find you never have any freedom, and you'll just get stressed and more stressed and more stressed in your life. What is the purpose of craving and desire anyway? Why do you want things? We want things so we can have some peace and some comfort in life. Always remember what the purpose of things are. Why do you want clothes? Why do you want a house? Why do you want a car? What's the purpose of it for? That's why a retreat center. What's the purpose of a retreat center? For allowing people to be peaceful. So if I stress out and get upset and angry, I'm missing the point of what we're having a retreat center for. A retreat center is so we can have a peaceful, compassionate and kind place to meditate. And if there are mistakes, actually, any of you who go to that retreat center, you find lots of mistakes there. They're put there on purpose. To show you that life is not perfect. That your wife has got lots of mistakes in her. Your husband has got lots of mistakes. Life has got lots of mistakes. Welcome to reality. So every mistake anyone sees in that retreat center, you know it's there for a purpose. To teach you how to be content with imperfection. If the mattresses are lumpy, if there's cockroaches crawling under the bed at night time, this is life. Look, when I was in Thailand as a monk, cockroaches weren't the problem. Tarantulas were the problem. They would crawl on the rafters and they'd drop down on you as they ran across your bare chest because it was hot. Many times I had tarantulas running over my body. They were tickly, that's all. This is life. So the purpose of this, what's done is finished. Imperfections are there in life. What is the problem? The problem is when we think it should be different, which means we have desires to control and change things and make it perfect. We try and do it the best we possibly can, but no more than that. Doing the best you possibly can, that is perfection. It's not the outcome, it's how it's done is where perfection lies. That's why Buddhism is a religion of freedom, but it really is a path, not a goal. It's the path, it's how things are done, not what is achieved. If you're an achievement-based person, then go to heaven, get in line, get psychic powers, be able to walk on water and fly through the air and leave the body with astral traveling. That's nothing to do with Buddhism. Not the goals, but the process, the path. That's why most people understand Buddhism, the middle path, the middle way, that's Buddhism. It's the path, it's the road, not the destination. It's not what you achieve, but how you do it. It's not what you gain, that's just desire. It's being at peace with things. Peace is a path, not a goal. Compassion is a way of living. Not something you want to get later on. It's what you're doing now. Understanding this, we also understand the importance of things like the law of karma. What is karma? Karma is nothing about explaining just why you've got a cough or why you're blind or why you sort of you got a bad arm because you punched an enlightened saint in your last life. That's not the law of karma. The law of karma means now is where you're making future. Karma is the actions you're doing now. It's the path you're treading in this moment is most important. Not where you're headed to, but the path you're on right now. What you're doing right now. How you're doing it right now. Good karma, the Buddha said very clearly, is your intention. Not what you're doing, but why you're doing it. The intention is the most important, is the essence of karma. Chedana ahang kamang vadami. I'm saying in Pali. Tell a few people that I do actually know what the Buddha actually said. Sometimes people think I just make it up, but no, chedana ahang kamang vadami. It's intention, I say, is karma. It's not what you do, it's why you're doing it, where you're coming from. So just think last week, questions like abortion. It's not what you do so much as why you're doing it, the intentions behind it. And that makes things much clearer to you. And makes it's not the act which makes it bad or evil or good or whatever, it's why you're doing it. People can give a donation. Wow, isn't that good karma? No, it's not necessarily good karma. Why are you doing that for? What is your intention behind that? That's what makes it good karma. It's the process, the path, not the actual, the goal. So understanding that makes morality much easier to understand. It makes it much closer to people's heart. Killing, is that wrong? Stealing, adultery, is that wrong? Abortion, euthanasia, is that wrong? Intention first, why are you doing that? What's behind that? That's where you find whether the thing is right or wrong. And that is how you feel. If somebody takes their grandmother over to the, was it Dignitas Clinic in Switzerland to have euthanasia? Is it wrong or is it right? What are they doing that for? If their grandmother was in great health but was very rich and you wanted their will, of course, you can see that's greed, and that'd be very wrong, and everyone would agree to that. But if that grandmother was suffering from some terrible disease and was in great pain and had no quality of life and no hope for any improvement, no realistic hope, who would say that was wrong? If it was coming out of real compassion, wise compassion, then the Buddha said, karma is the intention. It has to be wholesome. Now this is actually understanding something much deeper. It's not whether she dies or lives. It's why you're doing it. The path, the karma you're doing now. Because we understand that the law of karma is just this amazing thing. If you are doing kind, generous, real generous, selfless, peaceful acts right now, it has to give good results in the future. If you're a result-orientated person, the path is the most important part of the result. What you're doing now, how you're doing it, it is the process. So the retreat center, 2 weeks' time, that is not so important how it turns out. For me, what is more important is how we build it. Not the result, but how it's built and how it's made. That is the most important thing. The care, the commitment, the love, the energy, that is our retreat center. In the building is the retreat, not in the completion. The same when you're meditating. People who meditate because they want peace, they want to get jhanas, they want to get enlightened, they want to see the Buddha, they want to have psychic powers. That is not the point. It's how you're meditating right now. If you want nibbana, you never get it. If you're content, focused on the path, the process, the means, be content, be peaceful, be kind, be gentle. It's what you're doing. Not where you're going to get to. Now that is understanding what Buddha's abyss. It's the karma, what I've called meditation karma. If you want to have brilliant states of mind, wanting them is more desire, more craving, it just makes it more tense. Instead, be kind, be gentle, be peaceful, let go. Be content means being happy where you are. That is where nibbana lies. That's how you find the freedom from desires. One of the famous stories, I spend a lot of time teaching in prisons. I get very busy these days, so I've given that to other monks to do. Even this evening, one of the monks, forget which one it is this evening, is going to be teaching over in Karna prison farm. These two monks, who taught there last Friday? Susanna, he taught in Karna prison farm last Friday. So because I can't teach them anymore, we sent other monks, and one of the monks went teaching in Casuarina prison. I think it got a new name now, but it's in Casuarina, the big high security jail down there. And he'd been teaching a meditation class for a few weeks. And they asked him, can you stay behind? We want to sort of talk to you and find out who you are. You know, we like you. You're a friend. We've got some tea and some stuff for you to eat. So he stayed behind for half an hour. And they started asking him about life in a monastery. And some of you know this story. I'll do it in brief just to get to the punchline as quick as possible. What's it like in a monastery? And he said, oh, in a monastery, in my monastery, you get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. 4 o'clock in the morning, said the prisoners. Not even in solitary confinement you have to get up that time of the morning. And the monk said, well, actually, getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning in Bodhinyana Monastery is optional. You can always get up earlier if you want to. That's the only option. And what do you do? And he told the story of the day, you know, just meditating all through the morning, no TV to watch the late night movie. The breakfast, you know, just get a cup full of porridge and that's it, hardly any choice. And just, you know, just a small amount, just because we work really hard in the morning. And then what do? We work so hard. If you actually see, I've looked at the monks, how they work, and how hard they work. We work much harder than the professional workers who get paid. Sometimes, if you saw how hard I make my monks work, you'd probably, you know, complain to Kevin Reynolds, and, you know, we'd get the monks unionized, and I'd be in big trouble. Because I exploit the workers, but they just love doing it, and I love doing it as well. We work really hard. And the prisoner said, you never, ever get prisoners to work that hard. We got rights. And then when we sort of say, what do you have for lunch? You all know, you've been to a monastery, all in one bowl, all gets slopped in together. And sometimes it does get mixed up. Sometimes I'm quite careful to try and separate things, but I give my bowl to somebody else to take upstairs, and by the time it gets upstairs, you know, the custard's on the curry, the ice cream's on the spaghetti. And that's my life, that's what I get to eat. It all gets mixed up. And they said, even in prison, in the worst prisons, even murderers, they give like a little tray, and you can put your some potatoes over here, and your carrots over there, and you get trays there with separation. Not in a monastery, that's terrible. So what do you do in the afternoon? Can you have a game of soccer? Or a game of footy or something? No, monks don't do sport. So what do you do in the afternoon? Meditate. Oh, God. So you must hang out for dinner. We don't have dinner, you all know, we just eat in the morning time. No dinner in the evening. That's disgusting, they don't feed you in the evening. So what do you do then? Don't tell me. Meditate, yeah, that's right. We have a cup of tea between 6 and 7. So what do you do afterwards? You know, can you sort of play a game of cards or Monopoly? What do you do in the evening? Meditate. And what time do you go to bed? Actually, the monk said, bed? We don't have beds, we sleep on the floor. You know, those of you who visited my cave, I sleep on the floor, we don't have beds. That's terrible, they said. Even the worst criminal, they always give them a cot to sleep on. And they were so disgusted, surprised at how monks live, that one of them, this was their friend, they got to like this guy, one of them completely forgot where they were and said, that's so terrible in your monastery. Why don't you come in here and stay with us instead? He was actually invited to stay in jail. The prisons had a point. It was much more comfortable in any Australian prison than it is in our monastery. And why is it that many of you have actually volunteered to stay at Bodhinyana Monastery or at Dhammasala Nuns Monastery? Why is there a waiting list usually of people wanting to join a monastery and a waiting list of people trying to leave a prison? What is the difference? This is the main part of the story. What's the difference between a prison and freedom? And very clear, a prison is any place you don't want to be. It doesn't matter if it's got, you know, brick walls, concrete walls with razor wire, or it's just got a monastery where you can come and go whenever you want. If it's any place you don't want to be, that is a prison. any place you want to be is a monastery, is freedom. That's the whole only difference between freedom and prisons. If you want to be there, you're free. If you don't want to be there, you are in prison. And that opens up a great insight into life. How often do you feel you're in a prison? You don't want to be here. How many of you are in a job you hate? And your job is like a prison for you. You just don't want to be there. Some of you, unfortunately, are in a relationship which is like a prison for you. You don't want to be there. Some of you are in a sick, an elderly body, and your body feels like a prison for you. Some of you, and I hope very few, are sitting in this hall and don't want to be here. It means this hall is a prison for you. You can't wait till it's finished to get out. How many times in life do you feel you're in a prison? You haven't got freedom. You'll find that every time it's because you don't want to be here. That's called prison. That's its meaning. How do you escape from the prisons of life? You don't have to get rid of your job. You just change your attitude to wanting to be here. After all, they're paying you. Salary is another word for a bribe to make you do something you'd rather not do. If you really enjoyed your work, tell your boss and he'll cut your salary in half. I enjoy my work, that's why I don't get salary. So when you want to be here, you're free. How does your relationship not become a prison? When you want to be here with that person you're sitting next to. If you want to be here, you feel free. In life, in meditation, how do you get rid of the feeling you're in a prison, enclosed? You can't change life. Life is imperfect, like our retreat center. Like me, like my stupid jokes, like you, and all your imperfections as well. I've never yet met a perfect person in that sense, that there's no faults in them. If they were perfect, they'd be like a plastic model, unreal. It would mean there'd be no reason to love them. The reason we have love is so we can accept and embrace imperfection. That's what love means. To embrace the imperfections of another person, of ourselves, and of life. So to be free, we're happy to be here. It's amazing, you can be happy to be anywhere. And you feel so free and at peace. Because when you're happy to be here, you experience the freedom from desires. When you don't want to be here, you have all these desires of what you want to do, where you want to go, and how you want to get there. Happy to be here. At least, can't we spend some time in our life learning contentment, happy to be here, with all of your problems and difficulties? A lot of times we want to get rid of difficulties. That's why we never understand life. Happy to have difficulties. As I said in the mental health seminar, one of the great insights which I got from Buddhism was if you are in the medical profession, or if you're a psychologist, or a psychiatrist, a nurse, or any other counselor, or a monk, or a nun, your job is not to heal. Doctors should never look upon themselves as healers. Because if you always want to heal, you'll get frustrated and disappointed many times when the person you're looking after gets more sick or even dies. Your job is not to heal. Your job is to care. You can't always heal anybody, somebody, but you can always care for them. You can't always solve the problems in life. You can always be happy to be here, to care for them, to love being here, an imperfect person in an imperfect world. That's something you can do. And that's the meaning of peace, of freedom. It doesn't bind you to having to do something. It doesn't have binding you to have to find solutions to everything. It doesn't have to bind you to change this world into some sort of heaven-like existence. This is not a utopia. This is learning how to make peace with life, the freedom from desire, loving life as it is, you as it is, you are, your partner as he or she is, and your monks as they are, with all their stupid imperfections, idiosyncrasies, and funny ways of doing things. Now this is understanding what real perfection is. Perfection is never gained by following desires. We will never make a perfect retreat center. You'll never find a perfect partner. You'll never make yourself perfect. If you think the spiritual life is getting rid of all of your foibles and defilements, you're going to be wandering around samsara for lifetimes. It's not about getting rid of things. It's about making peace with things. Especially making peace with life. With our stupid mind, our old body, and our silly ways of doing things. When we're content, we're just happy to be here. We're at peace. We are now free. The freedom from desire. Happy to be here, content, needing no more wishes. At least you can do that for a little time in your life. Why not extend that time? Being happy, being content, to try your very best. And that's perfection. Not what you achieve, but how you do it. The process, the path, the middle path, the way, not the goal. Buddhism is a process, not a destination. So, that's what Buddhism is. Not a religion which binds you, but one which frees you totally. There we go. Buddhism in a nutshell. So now you know what Buddhism is, you don't have to come here again. So you're free, and I'm free as well. Okay, so that's the talk this evening. Hopefully you enjoyed some of it, most of it, but hopefully most of all, you're happy to have been here while it was being said. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So now, are there any questions or comments on this evening's talk? Yeah, there's one from Lawrence over there. Thank you so much. I'm very happy you're asking a question. It can. I suppose the word religion is saying that religion can have another mean of actually binding you or rather collecting you to the present moment, collecting your energies together. Yes, but I always like this more like a collecting is actually almost like a bit of force. It's actually, you never actually collect yourself in the present moment. You let go and the present moment happens. So actually collecting, gathering things up together, it sounds a bit too control-y to me. It's the same way that how we meditation. It's not concentration. Many of you have heard me say this before. Anyone who thinks meditation is concentration, you're missing the point. The old simile, you've seen this before, Lawrence. I'm going to now hold this glass of water absolutely still. I'm going to concentrate and collect all my powers and energies And mate, it's absolutely still. Is it still yet? Hokchin, you're the closest. No, it's not. So what should I do? Try harder. Are you trying hard? Thank you for that. Now I'm laughing, it's moving even more. It's still moving. I tried this many, many times. I've never been able to hold it still. And any doctor here would tell you that, you know, the muscles in your arms, the metabolism, metabolizing all the time. There's always going to be some movement there. It's impossible to hold this still. So how do you achieve stillness with a glass of water? It's very easy. You put it down. Not collecting things, but freeing things. Not holding, not doing, but freeing. And now that water is more still than I could ever hold it. For those of you who ever tried meditation, remember this simile. If you try and make your mind still, you'll never achieve it. You just get frustrated and tired. If you know how to let things go, to free, be content, put things down, the water becomes still all by itself. That is freedom, that's religion. Not holding, not even collecting energy, but freeing. Anyway, that's something to consider. Okay, thank you for that question. Anyway, Lawrence, great guy. Yeah, another question. My goodness, yes. Okay, he's talking about one of the other differences of being in a prison is in a monastery you can choose to go there and you can choose to leave there. And in a prison that you have no choice, you get sent there and you have no choice how long you have to stay there. In a sense, yes, but a lot of times people make the choices in life, they know what they're doing, and in a sense they choose that path which they should know was going to lead to jail. And those people already in jail, if they've got a good enough lawyer, they can choose to get out. But that's not really the main point. The main point is people don't want to be in prison when they're there. How they got in there is not the point. Now they're in there, they don't want to be there. And some people in a monastery don't want to be in there. That's why in our tradition we don't have life vows. If you have a life vow, it actually puts you in a prison. Because, you know, you may have, like I've been a monk now for 35 years now. And if I only was a monk because of something I said and did 35 years ago, you change your mind sometimes. It'd be terrible if there were life vows and I didn't have the freedom to leave whenever I wanted. But because you have that freedom to leave whenever you want, you don't want to leave. You're happy to be there. So the main thing is the prison is any place you don't want to be. And that can be just sitting in that seat now. And it can be just waiting at the airport for the plane. You don't want to be here, I want to be on the plane. How many prisons do you know in life? You're at the red traffic light and you don't want to be there because you've got things to do. You are now in a prison. In the red traffic light. Because you don't want to be there. That's the most important part of the story. How many prisons we make in our life. And how freedom is always there for us. Don't have to change the traffic light to green. Just have to want to be there. Standing in, sitting in queue, waiting for the car in front to move. Happy to be here. Okay. Okay, you're laughing. Oh, well, okay, the last question we have to leave. Yeah.
So how
should we understand right concentration? Okay, so you shouldn't try to concentrate. How do we understand right concentration as the last factor of the Eightfold Path? Samma Samadhi. These days I never say concentration. Remember, these are terms which over 100 years ago, the first translators, you know, from the Sanskrit or the Pali into English, they tried these words, and it's a bad word. Samadhi means stillness. The eighth factor of the Eightfold Path. Right stillness. Not concentration. Right stillness. If you understand that word, stillness, it makes it quite clear how to achieve stillness. And what is the obstacle to stillness? Anything which agitates your mind is an obstacle to stillness. Letting go. Letting go of that which agitates, which moves, which stirs up, that is a path to stillness. Third factor of the Eightfold Path, letting go of craving. That leads to deep stillness. It's an effort. An effort to stop, to say no, to restrain, not an effort to do. It's a much harder one, a much more refined one. In our world, we are great doers and controllers. We know how to put effort to achieve things. Few of us know how to stop. We've only got an accelerator. We forget where the brake is. Okay, thank you for your question.